You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 268 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
Hello.
We made it through the heat. We are here.
Hope everyone survived. It was very hot. Unusually hot.
Mm-hmm.
That's my analysis.
Yep. All right. Well, we've broken down that it was hot when it was 110 degrees.
Historically hot.
That is ESPN's Kevin Pelton's expert analysis.
I do want to say before we get going here.
Hello.
We got a great guest returning to the pod this week, so I hope everyone's going to enjoy that. But well, we're talking about our sponsor, Pagliacci Pizza. They're doing free slices.
There it is.
On Friday from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at all locations that serve slices.
All locations.
I mean, there's like a couple that don't have slices.
That serve slices.
Yes. But the vast majority of their locations, you know, check their website to be totally sure. But if you go there and you can order slices, they're doing free slices to thank customers for their support during the pandemic.
Wow.
And celebrate the reopening of dining rooms, as we have reached full reopening as of today in Washington State.
I know that they're the sponsor, but I say this without any recommendation from them or whatever. Pagliacci is the best business in Washington State. Right?
Yeah.
They were out there during the protest providing water to everybody. And then we make it, I'm not going to say we're through the pandemic, but we make it to dining rooms opening at the very least. And Pagliacci is there giving away free slices. Every time there's a Peltoncast live, save the date, September 18th, maybe, they will have slices there for you, the listener.
Can we commit to that yet?
That's what I said, maybe.
Okay.
That's why it's a save the date, maybe.
No. Can we commit to the Pagliacci?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No. We can absolutely... We'll fucking buy it if we have to. But
okay,
yes, you know what? I have no doubt in my mind. Pagliacci will be donating slices to you, the listener, because that's what they do.
There you go. Pagliacci.
Can we... Of course we can. All of a sudden, they're going to say no?
I don't like to guarantee things.
Look, the Pagliacci values you, the listener, as much as they value every single person who comes in the store from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Friday, July 2nd. But, sadly... neither you or I will be at a Pagliacci location on Friday, July 2nd, midday, because something else is happening.
That's true. I mean, I guess, you know, perhaps by 3, but...
Transitions nicely to our beer today.
It does. We're drinking from our friends at Fremont Brewing. The Giovanni Italian Style Pilsner.
There it is.
It was perfectly timed for this, for our segment talking about Italian soccer. Some details on this. The Bohemian Pilsner and Francine Pilsner malts with white wheat and Adina hops. The flavor is slight sweetness, and gently bitter in light body with moderate carbonation. Did you realize that there are different levels of carbonation in beers?
Absolutely, I did.
Did you?
You don't know that there's different levels of carbonation? Bro, that's why I'm like right here. Trader Joe's sparkling plain water. That's why that shit is hot, because it's got high level of carbonation.
But in beers, have you noticed that?
Absolutely, I have.
Okay. Congrats to you for noticing it. We'll toast to that. We are also toasting. We got some more Olympic news this week. Rose Lavelle and Megan Rapinoe from OL Reign named to the U.S. Women's National Team 18-player roster for the Olympics. And as expected, Katie Lou Samuelson named to USA Basketball's 3x3 Olympic squad, joining her teammates Sue Bird, Joel Lloyd, Brianna Stewart will be on the U.S. 5x5 squad, along with Ezzie Meg McGoran and Stephanie Talbot representing Australia in the Olympics. And then lastly.
Not lastly. There's more. More to go. Look, we're toasting with the Giovanni here.
Well,
and we're
true.
Not going to toast to Italy's 2-1 victory in extra time over Austria.
Okay, we can toast to that just now. Before we talk about it in a second here. But for the first time in about at least 19 months, a long period of time since 2019, we had H1 Unlimited Hydroplane action last weekend in Guntersville, Alabama.
There we go.
J. Michael Kelly won that race in the U8 Miss Tri-Cities.
That's
so congrats to J. Michael Kelly.
Renton Zone, J. Michael Kelly, is that true? Maple Valley?
It's definitely somewhere here down in the South End. I think Jimmy Shane might be Kensone, I guess. The both of them from South King County.
Well, he's
sure.
A long way from home. I want to say to you also, this is named the Giovanni from Fremont Brewing Company. That is one of the names that I considered for one of my many children.
Is it?
It sadly was not chosen. But other names that were considered and not chosen. John Luigi.
After Buffon.
Giorgio.
Chiellini.
And the one that I really fought for. The one that I fought hard. That I considered Andrea. Maybe a little complicated for a boy in America. Pirlo, though, as a first name. You can have that for free. This is my seven. Like, that is, it is the best name. I will fight forever that we should have had a child named Pirlo. And Matteo, which also, granted, Matteos are scoring all throughout the World Cup for Italy. But
that's correct.
Only one.
But scoring repeatedly.
Would he not seem like a Pirlo? Like, if he was just destroying the house, just tearing down the projector screen or whatever, throwing... You know about all the things that he did last weekend? Throwing a salt shaker into my neighbor's yard and having it shatter, just peeing off the deck. You'd be like, Pirlo, what are you doing?
Pirlo, that's Pirlo at it again.
It would have been perfect, wouldn't it? Normally, when you have a child, you're just like, wow, that child is so much that name. And which he is, right? But like, you can't ever conceive that a child has any other name. And I could conceive him being a Pirlo. It's like a little mischievous, I feel like.
Impish, maybe?
Impish?
I feel like Andrea Pirlo was impish.
Impish feels bad, though.
I don't feel like it's a negative thing, necessarily.
Okay.
Are you looking that up to see what it means?
No, I just... Inclined to do slightly naughty things for fun. Wow, that really is.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I know what words mean.
I know what words
mean. It's kind of a core part of my job description, I would say.
Wow, that's funny. I have the English degree, and you're out here knowing what words mean.
Although I considered using the word overwrought in my tweet about Rudy Gobert earlier this week, and it turns out that overwrought does not mean what I thought it does.
Wow, what do you think? What did you think it means?
I went with overstated instead. So I overwrought, I thought, was like the fancier way of saying that. But
in a state of nervous excitement or anxiety.
Yeah.
Huh.
We were in a state of nervous excitement or anxiety as that match went to extra time, tied at nothing on Saturday.
Yes.
Against Austria.
Are we coming back to that, or are we going into that right now?
We're going into that right now.
My favorite part about it is that I think you and I cheer for maybe the most hated team in the entire world.
Well, Jibber certainly is not a fan.
But in general, right? Wouldn't you agree that, like, to me, England is by far the clearly most hated team. But I think they lose a lot, England. And Italy is really annoying, but then they're like, every team that they play, they're like, Italy's record is 29-1 against this team, right? They have dominated many of these other European teams for centuries.
You said that Italy were the Blazers of...
Yeah, I don't know if that's quite right.
Italy are the Chris Paul of international soccer. Oh, I mean, they'd gotten to the highest level before, but there's a lot of Chris Paul to Italy.
We're going to find the exact right comparison for this.
We're going to work it through this.
Yes. I think people like Kevin Durant too much.
But some people.
They're sort of like you either love them or you hate them, but I do feel like the average soccer fan of European soccer, I think that they mostly hate Italy.
I think that's quite plausibly so.
And maybe it's the desultory style of play that Italy has played for
inventing defensive soccer, basically. Like Brazil invented play soccer with flair, yeah. And Italy invented let's play as defensive as possible.
Yeah,
let's
this
get
is
that
this is
in
not
there.
Total football. This is This is untotal football. Which we definitely
this is fractional football.
I mean, in that game on Saturday against Austria, match, if you will, in the parlance of football, Italy definitely dominated through the first half, dominated possession, had a number of chances. And then, you know, it felt like, and the commentary was the same, just beautiful British commentary. Look, we may hate England as a team, but their commentators are phenomenal. In the same way that Italians can coach.
And everybody. One of my favorite, they looked like Spain in the first half, like classic Spain, tiki-taka. One of my favorite English soccer phrases in commentary is when Ian Dark in particular says, they've lost the plot. And that's what it felt like Italy did in the second half of that match.
Really? kind of a surprising turn of events. And it was just like, things got kind of dark pretty quickly. I mean, there was a goal that was disallowed on VAR, pretty obviously. But in that moment, when that goal was scored, I think we both thought it was a clean goal in real time.
Yes.
And
but I have learned, I refuse to celebrate Italy's second goal of this match or until the VAR was clean.
It is kind of sad. It's the NBAification of scoring goals in major tournaments.
I mean, there's lots of baskets in basketball games, and very few of them actually get replayed. So it's not like the shot goes in and you're like, well, I don't know whether to celebrate or not. Mm-hmm. But in soccer, that's legitimately what it is now.
Yes. I mean, if it's close, there are times that you know. But
not even until you see the replay. Because they'd be fine and shit to be VAR.
But when that first goal was disallowed, even after that, there was a sigh of relief. And I mean, my feeling in that moment was, if that goal was good for Austria, Italy was losing. Like, I did not see them scoring a goal in those next 30 minutes or so.
I don't know. You play soccer so much differently when you're down in a knockout game. So I think it's possible they could have equalized. But it would have been a deserved goal for Austria the way that the game was going at that point.
And then, you know, not a lot of opportunities heading into extra time. And it felt like Italy was trying to just get to extra time, regroup. I felt in that moment, and I said the same to you, which you didn't agree with after. I was like, Italy's going to lose this match going into extra time.
I did not agree with that.
I think you agreed with it in the moment, but then after Italy won, you were like, I actually didn't agree with that.
I would just didn't want to jinx it.
And that's the way it felt. Like, that wasn't like a trying not to jinx it type situation. Austria looked better, and it felt like they were going to sneak a goal in.
But it felt to me like Italy's substitutes could breathe a little life to the attack. And that's what happened with Chiesa scoring off the bench.
And then eventually picking up two goals in relatively quick succession in overtime before Austria ended Italy's
Extra time.
What did I call it?
Overtime.
Overtime and extra time before Austria ended Italy's streak of not giving up a goal with a pretty phenomenal
Incredible off corner. Yeah, it was quite a finish.
So, you know, in hindsight, everything that happened after that, it felt like a pretty rough performance for Italy. It was also the first day of Sweet 16 matches, and therefore, as they call it in soccer.
You know, I was attributed something in the Oklahoman today. They said that I am like always saying that we need to celebrate the Final Four and calling it the Final Four in the NBA with the conference finals. And that is not a thing I've ever said. I have no idea who it was. I don't even think Kevin Arnovitz has said it. And usually when I get misquoted, it's actually Kevin Arnovitz who has said something.
They just quoted you on this in the Oklahoma?
Not like quoted, but it was like referenced in an Oklahoma
As column. Kevin Pelton always says, you got to call it the Final Four. People.
I mean, sure, that seems reasonable, I guess. I don't always say it.
God, fuck you, Oklahoma. Misquoting Kevin Pelton, stealing the Sonics.
There are so many worse things I could be misquoted about. Let me be clear.
Anyway, what happened throughout the rest of the Euro, you know, things have been fairly chalk through the first couple of days, but then seeing Spain go to extra time with Croatia ended up coming up with a victory, but then later that day, France losing on penalty kicks in pretty thrilling fashion. Was like, it was one of the greatest soccer moments as an Italian fan who hates France. Seeing Kylian Mbappe miss a penalty kick on the fifth penalty kick knock France out of the Euro. It was a beautiful thing. And then also later on seeing Germany go down to England, obviously at Wembley, but
Netherlands.
And Netherlands losing. It was basically they took the heat off Italy for a while.
Agreed. But the heat is on for Italy in the quarterfinals.
The one team who was sort of part of that, the tier of the top clubs in Europe who were in this round of 16, who didn't really struggle much in this round, was Belgium.
I mean, I was surprised to learn that France was the betting favorite going into this tournament, because to me, Belgium is the best team in the world.
They are ranked number one.
They are. Not
in the world.
FIFA
France is
the
reigning World Cup champions. And you look at that team, And the players that they're able to bring on, they're just like, Olivier Giroud, oh yeah, bring him in, yeah, right?
Sub, yeah.
The amount of just superstar caliber players that France has on the attack, especially when Pogba hit that goal, it was just like, fuck me. Like, if people are out here scoring goals like that, there's no competition. So having that team out of the tournament still feels pretty good.
It seemed there was no chance that Switzerland was coming back at that point. It was wild.
Oh, that was one of the most exciting goals. When he scored it and just crossed his arms, I was like, damn, nobody is beating this team. For me, I was like, I'm betting that they're winning. In that moment,
I told Baby Fantasy Genius that Pogba is my favorite type of player in soccer.
Well, I'm more of a Pirlo type.
we know your feelings. But Belgium did suffer some injuries in that match. So Kevin De Bruyne, Eden Hazard, their availability is still unclear for Friday's showdown in the quarterfinals. That gives you a certain degree of hope. I'm really upset that this is the matchup. Not only because of the fact that it's too good of a matchup for the quarterfinals, like you'd rather see this in the final,
mm-hmm.
If the draw were, you know, done better. But the other aspect of it is I really like Belgium. They're my second favorite
Belgium.
Team in the Euro by far. From my brief stint as a caring about the EPL and cheering for Everton, great fondness for Roberto Martinez and Romelu Lukaku. Who is so good.
Belgium. Come on, get out of here. I think Belgium is maybe the fan favorite of the tournament. There's smaller countries also that are still alive who I could see people rallying around. And I know who the fan least favorite is.
We're clear about that.
Who's left. But when you consider the injuries, when you consider the style of play, and the form that both teams have been in during this tournament, feels to me like it's a 50-50 proposition.
Yeah, I don't know how to handicap it. I'm not sure if we've got some lines here on the ESPN soccer page.
I do think, all things considered, the outcome of Belgium-Portugal was probably the best case scenario for Italy, seeing two of Belgium's top players get injured. Whether they play or not, they're probably not going to be at 100%. There's a good chance that Chiellini's going to be coming back for that match.
Don't see that on there.
So,
yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And it was very important that Italy win, you know, obviously to continue advancing in the tournament, but they also needed to win on Saturday because otherwise it would have screwed up the beer choice. I was saving that. I'd gotten this in the Pride beer last week.
You're wearing your Italian soccer jersey right now.
I am. Yeah. I'm fired up. Well, should we talk?
We can toast one more time to Italy, and all of the listener out there can cheer against Italy if you want to cheer against Italy at home.
All right. Well, the Seattle Kraken finally have the first head coach in franchise history. It's Dave Hakstol. And to learn more about this, of course, we had to bring back our number one Kraken correspondent. A hit the last time he was on this podcast, the first time we had a real Kraken segment. So please welcome back Ryan S. Clark of The Athletic Seattle.
How's it going, everybody?
It's going well. It's going well, especially now that it's cooled off. We kind of saw the backstory on this hire a little bit, the broad outlines of Hakstol's success at the college level and perhaps not as much success at the NHL level with the Philadelphia Flyers in his first go-around. But tell us a little more about, this is not a name that was on our radar, how this came to happen.
Sure. Well, I mean, some of it goes back to the fact that the Kraken have made sort of a habit of kind of playing things close until the last minute. It really wasn't until, let's say, the hour before the announcement when the name of Dave Hakstol began circulating. And it's definitely one of those moves that caught people by surprise because you just never heard the name because you heard so many others be mentioned with this job. But then when you kind of sit there and you think about the fact that, like, it was under the radar, he checks all the boxes of the Kraken. And it's the fact that, like, they see something in him, plus his history with Ron Francis, as well as Jason Botterill from representing Hockey Canada at the 2019 World Championships. All the pieces were sort of there. It was just, it's kind of one of those, the breadcrumbs were there. It's just maybe people were thinking it was something else when in some ways it kind of was there in retrospect. But in terms of the hire itself, Dave Hakstol, someone that in three full seasons in Philadelphia, he got them to the playoffs, two of those seasons. He never had a losing record in those seasons. Of course, his fourth season, he was fired through 31 games after the team struggled to a slow start. And since then, he's been with the Maple Leafs as an assistant. His responsibility was defense and penalty kill. And when you look at what they were able to do on the penalty kill, like, it was a Leafs team that, when you look at metrics, like high danger goals allowed, high danger shots allowed, chances against, the whole nine. Like, this was a team and a unit that ranked in the top 10. But when you look at their penalty killing percentage, that's where it was toward the bottom. So it's sort of one of those things where, which one do you kind of place more of an emphasis on, the overall percentage? Or do you look at it as like, hey, they did all these things to contain. It's just there were more goals than maybe they would have liked.
Can you explain what that means, penalty killing percentage?
Sure. So penalty killing percentage, the way that's calculated is how many penalties do you give up? And then how many goals? So you take the amount of goals you give up, you divide it by the amount of times you go on the penalty kill, and then that tells you what your percentage is. So like, if you are a kill that's between, let's say, 85 and 88% during the regular season, that's a really, really strong kill. If you're between 79 and let's say 82, 83, that's about lower to almost upper average. And so the goal for most teams is to try to be at 85 or above. The higher you can get, the harder it's going to be to score.
All right, let's go back to Hacksaw's time in Philadelphia. We got an email from the listener, Eric Gratz, talking about this. Is a Flyers fan, since Seattle didn't have a team growing up, I am shocked by this hire.
Wow.
I understand that there are some very good second-tenure coaches, a la Bruce Cassidy, apparently is a good second-tenure coach, in the NHL, but I didn't even know Hackstall was a candidate. He took a team with average to slightly above average talent to below 500 hockey. But the biggest thing is I don't know what those Flyers teams were good at or what their identity was, aside from having Claude Giroux. We obviously have no context for this. It does seem like the team got much better the full season after Hackstall was fired, when Alain Vigneault came in. But what was this considered a very talented team that underachieved during his tenure?
It all depends on who you ask, because there are some people who say when he and Ron Hextall, who was the GM of the Flyers, went into Philadelphia at that time, it was a team that was going through something of a rebuild. And it was a group that may have surpassed expectations quicker. But then there are people who say that they could have done more with that team because they didn't get out of the first round. But then there are also some things that have been questioned too, like how he managed younger players versus playing older players at a time when everyone in the league is not only trying to get younger, but younger players are receiving more key minutes over the last 5 to 6 seasons more than ever before. And a lot of people really attribute that to what we saw at the 2016 World Cup of Hockey, when Team North America, which at the time, imagine if Nathan MacKinnon, Connor McDavid, and Austin Matthews were all on the same team and they were paired with other talented players younger than 23. That's what team, 23 or 24, but essentially that's what Team North America was. And it allowed the league to see, like, you can put a lot of young skilled guys on a team and you can do damage. And so around that time is when you start seeing the shift. So that's kind of the thought with Hextall, with Dave Hextall, is like, on one hand, you know that he has won in situations and he has won in places. But on the other hand, there have been questions about personnel. And so what's this going to look like the second time around? When you look at how his systems operated defensively, they were in the upper half, really in the top 10 in terms of like fewest high danger goals allowed, high danger scoring chances allowed. But when you look at goals, that's where the production comes into question, because his teams were teams that could get shots from the point. But when it came to the net front, that was an area of struggle. And as anyone in the NHL will tell you, the more you can occupy the net front in the low slot, the higher the chances you're going to score goals. I mean, look at the first two games of the Stanley Cup Finals. Like, we've seen Tampa win games because they're active around the net front and they're active in the lower third of the ice.
So you think that, does that influence the style of roster that the Kraken build as they prepare for the expansion draft coming up next month?
I mean, it could, but at the same time, it's one of those things when you look at what made Ron Francis' teams sort of either work or their identity in Carolina, it was these two-way teams that were defensively disciplined. And yes, there were times when scoring might have been an issue, but defensively, it's kind of the bedrock of their whole operation. And so when you look at what Dave Hakstol provides, like, it fits in line with that. And in terms of what the Kraken could be, potentially that's the direction they could go. Because when you look at the players that could be available in the expansion draft, there's going to be a defenseman everywhere. Like, there's going to be some legitimate top four options. There's going to be players who are top six options that maybe under certain circumstances could become a top four option. But in terms of finding scores, like, your top six forwards, those are going to be the players that, again, it all depends on the situation. Some might come up in the expansion draft. Some might come up in free agency. There might be some they could get available for trade, but if they can get those sorts of players, then you could maybe see another look at how a Dave Hakstol system operates.
It is interesting, you know, your description of the team is rebuilding and then sort of seeing the fruits of that afterwards. It kind of sounds a lot like what happened with Ron Francis in Carolina. Is that a reasonable comparison?
Yes, because with Francis in Carolina, one of the things that got brought up was this. You look at how they managed under the cap. And the thought in Carolina was they could have spent close to the cap or even approached the cap. Like, this could have been a team that was more competitive, because during Francis's time there, every year the Hurricanes were involved in at least 24 one-goal losses. And so, like, it was a team that, like, really had to be structured about how to build from within. And then when you look at how they operated at the trade deadline, more times than not, the Hurricanes were sellers. And then when you look at what they did in free agency, like, they weren't really a team that were in a position to go after, like, not maybe not necessarily the big name free agent, but they weren't really in a position to make these big splashes. Whereas if you come to Seattle, one, you have an ownership group that's shown a willingness to spend money by the fact they're renovating, well, now Climate Pledge Arena, formerly Key, to the tune of $1 billion. And also they're spending between another 80 and 90 on a practice facility, which, after looking at it today and starting to see how it's coming more and more into focus, like, it's really gonna make an impact in terms of sort of how players are gonna be received, in the sense of, is this a place you want to play? Because things like practice facilities do matter to some players. And so that's the thought, is with Hakstol, by putting him in a different situation, maybe surrounding himself with a few different items, but the fact that he is a different coach, that's what they're banking on. Because it goes back to something that Hakstol said in a story we had at The Athletic. When he was in Philadelphia, he had people around him who could tell him all these things that come with being an NHL head coach, but he still hadn't experienced it yet, because his head coaching experience was in college, where in college, there's so much of a different structure. Because in college, you're playing Friday, Saturday, maybe the random Sunday. In the NHL, you're playing 4 days a week, and sometimes you're having back-to-back by the end of the week. And those back-to-backs increase, especially later on in the season. And the steps that he would have learned coaching in the AHL, he didn't get that first time in Philadelphia. Whereas if going to Toronto, he had already been a head coach, so he already knew what to look for. And he could watch what Mike Babcock and Sheldon Keefe were doing to say, okay, this is how they handle these situations. And having been in this chair, I now see what this means. And so while, yes, he was coaching and doing the things that he did to get him to the level of success he had at UND, which got him the Flyers job, he also really used it as a sense to sort of go back to school, in a manner of speaking, to figure out, okay, where were the areas where I struggled? So if a second chance does come, I can say and show to people, this is where I sort of made up for those mistakes.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I mean, first off, this was an unusual transition that he undertook. We think about this in basketball, where it's a difficult translation to go from coaching at the college level to the NBA level, but it's something that happens on a pretty regular basis. In the NHL, it hadn't happened since 1982, when he was hired by the Flyers in 2015. So it's a pretty dramatic shift. And I liked, as you mentioned in your story, how open he was about, you know, his growth as a coach, and that he's not the same coach that he was in Philadelphia.
Well, and that's just it. Is, I mean, anytime you give someone a second opportunity, there's always going to be that conversation about why is that, especially right now when you look at the NHL, and there are a lot of first-time coaches in the league, like John Cooper is a first-time NHL coach, Jared Bednar, Jeremy Colleton. There are quite a few. DJ Smith is another one that comes to mind. And so, like, if you're going to give a coach a second chance, like, it usually has to be the sort of candidate that you look at it and go, okay, where can you see the progress? So earlier you mentioned Bruce Cassidy. Bruce Cassidy goes to the Bruins, and the Bruins are, for the most part, a perennial cup contender. If not cup contender, they're in the conversation for the Eastern Conference Finals. Or like with Barry Trotz, when he left the Predators to go to the Washington Capitals, and then from the Capitals to the Islanders, like Barry Trotz is going to the Hall of Fame. Like Barry Trotz teams have longevity. And so when you're looking at these second chance coaches, that's the big question, is what did they learn from the first time and how will that apply for the second time going? And with Hextall, those are the things that if you're him, you had to be honest about it in job interview. And not only that, but like when people ask you about it, it is going to be the narrative surrounding everything you're doing.
You mentioned getting a tour of the practice facility as they announced the name of that today. What did you see? How close are they getting to a completion there?
So today it was part of course, the partnership that they have with Starbucks, the community partnership. And as part of the press setting there, they were giving members of the media a miniature tour. And so when you look at where things are going compared to the last time media was in, there are walls up. There's paint on the walls. There's the color scheme. You can see where a lot of the decks for the rinks have been laid. They've got boards, like the actual boards in there, maybe not installed, but like you can see them in chunks bit by bit. And Todd Lewicki said today that they expect that this thing will be ready in August, that people will be able to move in, as in, of course, their employees, because that is where the team will be headquartered in terms of its front office operation, with the idea that this thing will be ready for training camp.
Yeah, and he also said the Climate Pledge Arena will be ready for the start of the season, which we found out, you know, it's been the assumption all along, but Gary Bettman mentioned it in his state of the NHL address at the start of the Stanley Cup Finals that, you know, they're still looking middle of October, that traditional timeline to start. So that was I think, a pleasant surprise, given that previously the timeline was a pretty vague sometime in October, which is a large target at this point.
It is, but you know, when you talk to people like the Kraken and you kind of get that answer, they've gotten a little bit more detailed. For them, it's like, it's not saying that the last brick or the last thing will be installed in October. Like, for all they know, that could get done by September, but in the sense of going through approvals and inspections and getting the green light from the parties and powers that be to go through with it, like that's where it could take time on the back end, but they sound confident that they should have everything wrapped up by the time the season starts.
Which is interesting because it does suggest an outside chance that the Storm might be able to play there if they reach the WNBA Finals, which would take place in the early part of October, which would be very exciting, although also probably logistically challenging if you played your entire season in Everett and Angel of the Winds Arena and then are trying to play finals games at a brand new arena. So we'll see on that one. Some of the other news lately, the agreement they announced on Monday with the Florida Panthers to use their AHL affiliate, the Charlotte Checkers, next season before the Kraken's affiliate in Palm Springs comes on board, seemed a little surprising in terms of geographically. That's not the most ideal location you'd want for your minor league team, right?
But again, you think about the breadcrumbs and, hey, the Carolina Hurricanes, their AHL affiliate was the Charlotte Checkers when Ron Francis was there. So like there is a pre-existing relationship. And while, yes, geography is mentioned, it's not like this is the first time you've had a West Coast team with an AHL affiliate on the East Coast. The Vancouver Canucks had the Utica Comets for years before the LA Kings were able to get their affiliate in Ontario, California. Their affiliate was in Manchester, New Hampshire. And so, yes, there are going to be some challenges. So, for example, if you need to call someone up and you're on one time zone and they're on another, you hope people are away so that way they can answer the phone and you can figure out logistics and who needs to be where. But in the sense of like where to be, the thing was always going to be this. The Kraken were always going to be in a little bit of a crunch because last year with the pandemic really, really, really showed that sometimes places can be hard to come by in terms of playing. And what I mean by that is last year with a lot of the prospects who were trying to play in their draft year, when the junior leagues like the OHL, WHL, and QMJHL weren't playing, there were some of them who tried to go play juniors elsewhere in Canada, elsewhere in the United States, if not go to Europe. And those spots filled up quickly. And when you look at the AHL, it's the same thing. There's only so many roster spots. But what makes those roster spots even more critical is development. So if you are a team with an AHL affiliate, the AHL affiliate serves a couple purposes. The first is it allows you to have a place where guys who are in between the NHL and AHL can play. So that way you can monitor, see how they're doing. Maybe there's someone there who gets called up because they're performing, or maybe there's someone there who's playing well that you can trust in the event someone at the NHL level gets injured. But what it also allows you to do is this. For prospects who are eligible to play in the AHL, it gives them a chance to play against different competition. So usually with most prospects who play in North America, so in other words, the WHL, the OHL, OHL, QMJHL, or they play the, or they go the collegiate route, those players are going to be developing against players their own age. And then when they are eligible to go play in the AHL, there's a transition that they're going to go from playing against players around their own age and around their same build to playing against people who are 10, 12 year professionals who've had that time in a weight room, who know these things to look for in an AHL environment that might be new to you. Whereas if you're a player coming over from Europe, you're used to playing against grown men. But the thing that's different is it's the size of the ice. In Europe, the ice is much larger. So there's more space. There's a lot more of an element to where you can find and pick and choose these spots. Whereas if you're in the AHL and you're in North America where the rink is smaller, like you've got to be quicker with your decisions because there is less space and someone who is used to that will pick you apart. So that's a long way of saying that to get those roster spots, it's critical, but to give up those roster spots for a team is even more crucial because that's 8 to 12 players you could be developing or trusting in the event you go through a serious rash of injuries.
Interesting. How much movement is there between the AHL team and the NHL team?
A lot. So you look back at this past season because of the taxi squad, because of the fact of, again, COVID, the pandemic, and how everyone was trying to manage it. Like it was a lot, but in a regular NHL season, like every day, it seems there's someone going back and forth between the AHL and the NHL, maybe not with that particular team, but every day it seems like there's some sort of transaction with an NHL team and its AHL affiliate somewhere throughout the league. So again, injuries pop up. There might be someone inconsistent in your lineup and you want to rest them, but you want to give someone who's performing at the AHL an opportunity to see how they do. There's all sorts of reasons as to why, but yes, there's a frequency in terms of how much teams call up players from the AHL or even send players to the AHL if they need developing.
I thought for sure you were going to ask about the ice size.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely no. Caught you off guard. That's
did you know that?
Yeah, because the Olympics is a different size rink, right?
I was just looking to confirm whether you knew that or not.
We've definitely learned the hierarchy.
Yeah, it's a fair thing because, covering the Avalanche, they had a prospect from Europe, Martin Tout, who had played in the Czech Republic. He comes to the U.S. and they're like, yeah, the ice size is different. They had another player, Pavel Francouz, had started in the Czech Republic. He'd started over in Russia. Like he was adapting to North American hockey. And as a goaltender, like having smaller ice means you have to read things differently, adjust to things differently. So yeah, like that's just it. It's like we talk about the play, but even something like rink dimension do make a difference.
So as we record this on Wednesday night, it's 3 weeks away from the expansion draft on July 21st. What kind of news do we expect in that period? Obviously, the big things are out of the way now with the coach hire, but what more can we look forward to?
A couple things. So one, you're probably going to start seeing trades. It's not to say that there's going to be a flurry of them, but the reality of it is this. There are going to be teams that know they're going to lose someone because they can't protect them. But it's that argument of like, do you try to move someone to get something in return? Or do you just say, screw it, we'll lose someone? And so we have a mailbag that's actually coming out tomorrow that's asking, where a fan asks that same question. So an example of that would be like when the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Montreal Canadiens actually made a trade before the Vegas expansion draft. So Tampa was in a situation where Jonathan Drouin was going to be exposed. And that's a really good player to leave exposed, and you lose him for nothing. So they trade him to Montreal in exchange for Mikhail Sergachev. Montreal is able to protect Drouin because, like, they're like, okay, we have a spot for him. Sergachev, because of when he was drafted, was exempt. So that meant the Lightning were able to get a prospect in return who turned into a really good player for them, and he was exempt from being selected. So it was a win-all for everyone, but this is something that has been done for a long time. Even like you think about the 1999 expansion draft with the Atlanta Thrashers, like Roman Turek was a goaltender that, like, if the Thrashers had had him, like, that would have been a really good starting point for an expansion team. But he was traded away because his team wanted to get something in return instead of losing him for nothing. So you could see some of that, and then also side deals. So maybe there's a possibility some of those leak early. It's doubtful given just how quiet Ron Francis and the Kraken have kept everything. But again, these side deals are things that if they hadn't been talked about already, they're going to gain more momentum in the coming weeks.
Nice. Well, definitely we know you're going to be on top of it as news continues to break. Been enjoying your Kraken coverage and hoping that...
I wanted to ask one more question about Dave Hakstol, though. And just curious, for you as somebody who's way more on the inside, obviously, than us, who's the farthest away from the inside to the outside as we can be, what has the response been both locally in Seattle and then around the league? Is this something where we know it came out of left field, but is this the first time that the Kraken have missed, so to say, or that they've taken, it feels like the approval rating's basically been 100% for the organization so far. Is this something where they saw a little bit of criticism or blowback or questions?
They definitely received all of the above. I mean, usually when they make a decision, we've all seen it on social. It's sort of this overwhelming praise, and it's kind of that joke of, like, they haven't played a game yet, but they're already winning. People have said that. But with this one, this was something that, like, definitely raised some eyebrows and made people kind of go, I don't know, did they make a misstep? Because when you think about, like, who is available, Rick Tocchet was the name that kept coming up, and with good reason, because, like, yes, he parted ways with the Arizona Coyotes, but at the same time, it was a little bit of that idea of, like, okay, if you put Tocchet in a system where he's going to have more resources than what he had with Arizona, then who's to say he wouldn't win? Because talking to people around the league, the point that kept coming up about Rick Tocchet was people forget that first year in Arizona, the Coyotes lost 20 straight games. And by year three, he got them into the postseason, playoff bubble or not. They still beat Nashville in the qualifying round. And after three games with the Avalanche, they kept things tight, only to then fall apart and lose the series in five. And so that is why people felt, like, strong about Tocchet. Whereas if, like, you look at Hakstol, and it has created those questions for all the reasons we've mentioned, the fact that, again, it was the hire that people didn't see coming, but also it's just the idea too of, like, you're so used to seeing the Kraken pick up these sort of people that just makes everyone go, oh, wow, that for this move, and it's a weird kind of strange thing to say, it maybe didn't have that flair and that panache that people are used to having. But at the same time, it's still much of a wait and see sort of proposition, because right now you have Dave Hakstol being very open about, like, I've learned from Philadelphia and I saw what happened there. But you think about, like, some of the things you hear from people. So, like, for the story we did, we got a chance to talk to, like, Ron Hextall, and Hextall talked a lot about how, like, there were some things that Hakstol was able to do in Philadelphia that you look at that, what he's learned, that, like, there's reason for confidence. Ron Francis felt the same way. But then there have been others throughout the league that have questioned this. But again, it's one of those things where you're never going to know until you've seen enough games. Because, like, look, people, when Gerard Gallant went to Florida, there are people who are like, okay, he'd been a head coach before, he was an assistant, what did he learn? Gallant got them to the playoffs and, of course, was ultimately let go. He goes to Vegas, and in Vegas, he was able to do some things with that team, but it didn't lead to the position the organization would have liked, so they moved on from him. And now he's with the New York Rangers, which, like, his track record shows he's a coach that can work with you. His track record shows that he can handle the attention given what he did in Vegas. It's just now a matter of like, what does this look like? Whereas if with Dave Hackstall, there are still questions about what this will look like. So until those questions really get answered, that's where there's going to be so much conversation about how this is all going to work for the Kraken.
Yeah. I mean, like we discussed, there's, it seems like, at least from what he's describing it, he has learned things from being back on the bench, right? And being an assistant in the NHL, obviously has prior NHL experience. But then the same question, like from the listener email, we don't know what he's good at yet.
Well, we have an idea based off of his time in Philadelphia, but again, things change, dynamics change, because Ron Francis really made this point. And he talked about, like, again, the things you learn as an AHL coach making the transition to the NHL that you don't get as a collegiate coach. And so, like, when you are an AHL coach, there's a lot of different things compared to a college coach. So, like, let's take college hockey. When you're the head coach in college, there's a lot of things you're responsible for. And not only that, but like you're dealing with age groups between 17 and let's say 23, 24. Whereas if you're an AHL coach, you're dealing with ages that range through a much larger, wider spectrum. You're dealing with personalities that are more mature, more defined. Some can still be molded. Some guys are who they are. And then it's the fact that, you know, not being funny, it's the difference between dealing with college students versus adults.
Yeah.
And with college students, not to say that there aren't aspirations, because those guys want to get to the NHL. But for the adults who are making money where this is their livelihood, like, it's a lot more real in terms of how all that works. And again, it's like even not even just like that, but it's also in some like stretches too. Like, what are the other things that coaches in the AHL have to deal with that in colleges you don't? Like, so in college, recruiting is such a big thing. In the AHL, you don't really have to worry about recruiting, but the time that you would be spending recruiting is time you could be spending doing other things. But then that's the other part of it too, is like, as a coach, how often and involved do you want to be? So when I was talking to Gallant for a story we did about what's it like to be the first head coach of an expansion team, a point that he made was, is as a coach, you want to be available, but you don't want to be someone who's always present. Because for some guys, going to the coach's office is a lot like going to the principal's office. You just want to stay away from it. And so again, it's about not only how do you manage personality, but also what's the best way for you to manage people? Because it's not that you can't lose college kids. It's not that you can't lose professionals. But at the same time, like, the medium is the message. And those are things that when you're in college versus when you're in professional, those are completely different challenges that you have to master. And again, the thought is, being in Toronto and his experiences in Philadelphia, would this further justify the decision made by the Kraken front office and ownership?
Well, I think the most important advantage that he has as compared to Philadelphia is it must have been very confusing to have Hackstall looking for Hackstall. Yeah. This is like, this is very tricky to keep straight. I'm glad we don't have to deal with that. As I was saying earlier, though, we're really enjoying your coverage and hope all of the listener is as well and looking forward to more of it. And can we check back in with you after the expansion draft in 3 weeks here to talk about the results?
Possibly, because I've said that once the expansion draft, free agency, and the entry draft are done, I am going to be a ghost. So we'll say possibly.
That's fair. It's been a long process. Well, thanks so much again for joining us.
Hey, no problem. Thank you guys so much for having me. It's always a blast.
Thanks, Ryan. This is awesome.
Should we talk about Seattle food?
Absolutely, we should.
Our search for Seattle's best fried chicken took us last Saturday, before the heat wave started in earnest, to Ballard and to Watson's Counter, which was opened by chef owner James Lynn with chef Scott Lukehart in early 2019. Watson's Counter, named after Lim's dog, a Maltese Yorkie mix, quickly became quite popular for a menu that fuses breakfast food and Korean cuisine. And they advertised their chicken sandwich as, quote, Seattle's best, which... was not a competitor in our search for Seattle's best sandwich. I don't know if I would take this over Mauno.
No.
But
it was good. It was a good chicken sandwich, but
a very good chicken sandwich. We got a variety of things here to split between us and Mrs. Fantasy Genius. We got the chicken and waffle with the naked wings to try to get kind of the most fried chicken-y option possible on the menu. We got the chicken thigh chunks with honey butter sauce. We got the aforementioned chicken sandwich with gochujang blend. And finally, we got cereal French toast with fruity pebbles.
Hell yes.
I didn't like that quite as much as I was expecting to. The French
toast. I think when we ate it, it wasn't hot enough.
That's fair. Because I ate all of the chicken that I had before you and your family met us at Golden Gardens to hang out there briefly. And that I waited for until you guys came because I wasn't sure if I was having any of that.
I think that would have been really good. But the like butter cream that was on it and then the fruity pebbles as the crunch on the outside, I thought was really good.
I also may not have gotten enough of that cream. That may have been a downside as well. But to me, the sandwich was the star here.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I thought the gochujang was like super flavorful on there. And that was the one thing that, you know, I'm evaluating the chicken. Like, I think their specialty is the sauced chicken. They do wings as well, which we did not have here. And that's a slightly different specialty. We've talked about this at a few different locations than being Seattle's best fried chicken.
Yeah, I thought the chunks, basically the chicken chunks or whatever chicken pieces that were flavored, phenomenal. The fry on the fried chicken, it was a chicken wing. Literally the texture and the thickness of the fry, perfect.
Agreed.
It was an absolutely perfect fry. Flavor wasn't quite as much there, but the quality of the fry was maybe the best quality of a fry we've seen on any chicken anywhere.
Interesting. I'm not sure if I had it rated that highly, but I definitely think, like, you know.
Literally just the crunch of it, you know?
It probably almost in some ways, given the saucing that they do, would be bad if you had too much flavor on the chicken because it would be overwhelming in some ways.
So I could have done with a little bit more flavor on the chicken. And I think they described it as lightly spicy, which didn't get a ton of spice with it.
And I didn't get that note.
And then also the chicken wasn't, you know, I was talking with Mrs. Fantasy Genius about this. We were sitting there and she was talking about how great the fry was. And I was like, absolutely. It's phenomenal. This fry. And I was like, the flavor of the chicken itself inside in the wing. A wing is a little bit harder than other pieces of chicken to brine.
Correct.
But like, they didn't have a lot of flavor in the actual chicken itself. Once you got down to it, that juiciness that can explode out of chicken, and I think that's what sort of brought it down for me from being a legit competitor for Seattle's best fried chicken. She was like, "Can that be a thing? Can the
Seattle's
chicken taste
fry?
No. Can the chicken taste good itself?" And I was like, "Absolutely." I was like, "Here's what chicken should taste like." And now that we've been through the search, I feel like my whole perspective of, you know, what kind of the perfect chicken is has really transformed during this time period.
Your palate has expanded.
I mean, it should have, right? I've eaten a lot more fried chicken, especially critically in the last 3 months or whatever than I ever had in my entire life beforehand. And I'm like, okay, this is exactly what I'm looking for. I want to bite into a piece of chicken and I want there to be juices that are coming out of it. And I want it to be really flavorful juices that are coming out of it. And it didn't quite hit that. Again, it was a wing, so it's a little bit harder to do that.
Well, I think that Watson's Counter, I think, is going to be a much stronger competitor when we do our search for Seattle's best chicken wings.
All right. Is that a thing we're doing?
Summer 2024.
Okay.
That's what it's scheduled for.
Mark your calendars.
Someday I make us do barbecue. We keep pushing off barbecue.
Am I anti-barbecue?
I don't know if you're anti-barbecue, but you did push forward fried chicken, so that was, which was a good decision. Do you have a rating for Watson's Counter?
I'm going to give it an 87.
It was going to 84, a little lower. So, again, I don't think probably in the knockout stages of this, but definitely a place I look forward to going back
and
to.
And just as a restaurant, right? Beyond, we're just judging the fried chicken.
Right.
The chicken sandwich, we basically have to wipe from our minds.
I don't know if we have to wipe it from our minds.
But it's not. It's literally not part of the search.
It is not part of the search, no.
So if you were overjudging...
We can compartmentalize it. We don't have to, like, you know, do the Men in Black scan to forget that we had it.
Mm. We have to Eternal Sunshine go through and wipe the memory of that fried chicken from our minds.
Oh, that's going to be a lost
2 minutes I spent eating that fried chicken sandwich, the time I spent cutting it with the knife I brought because I knew that I was going to need a knife to slice that open.
That is high-level preparation, people.
Look, you know, the chicken's not going to search for
itself. I brought nothing. I brought on CD Darkness on the Edge of Town and the Black Album. Because I realized
you
that...
You did
that
three children.
I brought three children and a minivan to drive those children around in that I realized has a CD player. And I have literally thousands of CDs in my garage. And it took 3 years to click that I should open up that box of CDs in my garage and play some of those. And especially play Darkness on the Edge of Town, which sounded phenomenal. That was a 10 out of 10.
Are you going to continue your tradition of Born in the USA on the 4th of July?
Absolutely, I am. No doubt about it. Yeah, it was a perfect 100 out of 100, Darkness on the Edge of Town on the way there. And then another 100 out of 100, the Black Album on the way back.
Somehow it got more than 100 out of 100. I don't know how that's possible.
I was flipping through CDs, and they have I have Velvet Underground bootleg CDs or whatever. And I was like, I don't think this is for the kids right now. I was like, we could start with White Light, White Heat first, and then move to the bootleg.
How much did the kids enjoy Darkness on the Edge of Town?
Oh, I said, children, do you want to listen to Darkness on the Edge of Town or the Black Album? Not knowing anything about it. And Marco goes, Darkness on the Edge of Town. And I'm like, just give it to me.
There you go.
Give me Badlands right now.
Well, our search for Seattle's best fried chicken will continue next week, but did want to come back to a topic we discussed a few weeks ago, which were, of course, the allegations of sexual misconduct against Chef Eduardo Jordan. And we got an email from the listener, Zach Jabal, who worked in the restaurant industry and had this to say. Appreciated the two of you taking the time to address the allegations against Eduardo Jordan and the broader topic of abuse within the restaurant industry. I thought you were largely on point, but I wanted to share my thoughts as a longtime restaurant industry veteran. There's no doubt that the rise of celebrity chef culture and the heightened power imbalances it created have allowed for some of the behavior that Jordan and many others engaged in. They probably felt like their stature protected them from repercussions, and surely it made those that they took advantage of or abused less comfortable speaking out, either to other managers or eventually to the public at large. Yet I've also witnessed a great deal of this kind of behavior being perpetuated by chefs and managers who've never come near a James Beard Award or even local acclaim. The sense when I first joined the restaurant industry over 2 decades ago was that I was working in an industry that didn't have the same kind of rules as many others. That certainly included conversations and interactions of a sexual nature that would not have flown in an office setting, but also encompassed a permissive attitude towards alcohol consumption, drug use, and lots more. Most restaurants didn't even have a nominal HR person, and even in large corporate chains, there was little oversight of management at the individual restaurant level. As a young white man, that didn't particularly faze me. I wasn't particularly the target of unwanted attention and enjoyed the general freedom of the industry. It wasn't until I was older and more aware that I realized how my coworkers might have been much less at ease with these circumstances, but unable or unwilling to either speak out or change jobs. Obviously, some of the issues raised by these allegations are shared more broadly in society, and some are indeed a byproduct of celebrity worship coming to the restaurant industry. But many of them are far more endemic than the public realizes. It's a sad reality that these kind of articles are themselves an element of celebrity chef culture. An article detailing the abuses of an anonymous chef might never get written or would certainly not get the same level of attention. Remaking the restaurant industry into something much safer, supportive, healthy, and remunerative for all workers is obviously a massive task, and one that will require buy-in from workers, management, diners, and the media. While these stories are undoubtedly painful, they do help reinforce the notion that this kind of behavior was and is widespread and must be noted, reported, and stopped. So, appreciate that perspective from Zach and the feedback.
Absolutely. And I think it seems very evident to me that it is not endemic of the restaurant industry or the film industry or the music industry.
Or as we're going to talk about in a second here, sports.
Or the sports industry. It is something that has been pervasive throughout society where there is a separation of power that exists. And, you know, I think the culture that has been created has really ignored these claims over the last thousands of years. But
over the last all of the years.
All of the years. And it is something where, you know, people facing, again, I guess, as we're about to talk about, people facing consequences because of them is really important as far as changing what that culture looks like, both in those industries that we named and in ones that...
And in society at large.
It might not be a news story if somebody is sexually harassing their employees, you know? So I think that's an important thing to consider, that there are places where it's not a Seattle Times story when somebody is acting that way because there isn't any sort of notoriety involved, but it's something that's still happening at those locations.
So sadly, this does transition us, as we were implying there, into talking about an update on the Blazers coaching search, which concluded when they introduced Chauncey Billups as head coach on Tuesday, a move that was overshadowed by the follow-up from 1997 rape allegation against Billups. Although no criminal charges were filed at the time, Billups and teammate Ron Mercer were sued along with a roommate of their also teammate Antoine Walker, at whose home the alleged rape took place. The players settled that suit out of court in 2000. After my ESPN colleague Idrin Wojnarowski reported Friday night that the Blazers and Billups were negotiating a contract as their choice over the other finalists, Mike D'Antoni and Becky Hammond, the hire came under fire, as well as Damian Lillard's role in it, after Lillard publicly voiced his support for either Billups or Jason Kidd, who withdrew from consideration from the Blazers coaching search and was later hired by the Dallas Mavericks after Portland parted ways with Terry Stotts. On Saturday night, in response to a Raptors fan who tweeted, quote, "This is on Dame, in my opinion. They were always going to hire exactly who he wanted. He wanted Billups or Kidd." Lillard, quote, tweeted that and replied, "Really? I was asked what coaches I liked of the names I heard, and I named them. Sorry, I wasn't aware of their history. I didn't read the news when I was 7, 8 years old. I don't support those things. But if this is the route you all want to come at me, say less." On Sunday, Chris Haynes of Yahoo Sports, whose relationship with Lillard dates back to Haynes' time covering the Blazers for NBC Sports Northwest, reported that, quote, "The enormous backlash from the Blazers' process to hire a new coach and his concerns on whether a championship contender can be built have become factors that may push Lillard out the door." Haynes reported that Lillard, quote, "played no role in consummating the hire." The Blazers did not manage to make matters better with the press conference Tuesday in Portland introducing Billups. At that, Neil Olshey, the head of basketball operations, began by saying, "We're aware of and understand the concerns that have been expressed by some people regarding some serious allegations Chauncey faced in 1997. We took the allegations very seriously and treated them with the gravity that they deserve. We wanted to make sure we had our own thorough process because some things are bigger than basketball," concluded by saying, "We also commissioned an independent investigation into the incident in question in 1997. The findings of that investigation corroborated Chauncey's recollection of the events that nothing non-consensual happened." Asked about that investigation by Sean Hyken of Bleacher Report, Olshey said, quote, "That's proprietary, Sean. So you're just going to have to take our word that we hired an experienced firm that ran an investigation that gave us the results that we've already discussed." Jason Quick of The Athletic reported that, based on a source, that the team commissioned a former FBI investigator to retrace the case. Witnesses were re-interviewed. Tapes of past interviews were watched. Billups, in his interviews with the team, was questioned about the particulars. But, you know, we've seen this with Frank Clark, that investigation by the Seahawks before they drafted him, where they admitted that they had not actually interviewed the victim in the case, who's probably the most important testimony. And in general, I would say that these investigations are designed more to be able to answer that question, I think they are, than to actually get to the bottom of the matter.
I mean, it's also not what a sports team does, right? Like, I feel like the threshold here for a sports team conducting an investigation like this, the honesty that's involved with it, of the take our word for it, that's proprietary, that I don't trust. But like, this is not an infrastructure that a professional basketball team has or probably should have in place. It's more about the transparency that exists.
Correct. Yeah, I think that's the bigger issue there. And that also became an issue. So Billups said in his opening statement, "There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about how every decision that we make can have a profound impact on someone's life." And later said of that allegation in that day, "It's impacted every decision that I make, and it's shaped me in some unbelievable ways." Billups was asked to follow up on how it shaped him by Jason Quick of The Athletic, and Blazers Senior Vice President of Communications, Community, and Diversity, Ashley Klinkscale, who was moderating the press conference, cut the question off and said it had been, quote, asked and answered. So that became kind of the defining storyline of that press conference. I would say for more on this, we talked about it on the Hoop Collective podcast that I was on earlier this week. We taped that on Monday, so it was before the press conference, but kind of went into, you know, how this all happened and my thoughts on it. So I would encourage everyone to listen to that.
I guess just one last thought on that is the Damian Lillard role within this, which I think has ended up leading to a very complicated place with him as a star player for the Blazers, who was asked a question about who he liked and said two names, which clearly are going to be the most familiar to Damian Lillard, right? There's a former NBA star from the city of Oakland, where Damian Lillard is from, and there's a former NBA star point guard. Like, obviously, there's going to be the most prominent names to Damian Lillard, and I don't think it's fair to necessarily say that Damian Lillard, when asked that question, should know about everybody's past. You know, it's something where as things are brought to light, I think he can change his perspective on it. And it seems like he may have. But to place the entire blame of this coaching decision on a player, I don't think is, and maybe this is what you talked about on the Hoop Collective.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's that, like, look, I'm sympathetic to the fact that he didn't know at the time. His attempts to distance himself from this decision, I think, ring a bit hollow because, you know, he talked to all of the coaching finalists individually. At the very least, he didn't say, this is a reason for us to not hire Chauncey Billups, I think it's fair to assume. But this decision rests with Neil Olshey. It rests with Jody Allen, the owner of the team. Bert Colde from Vulcan, who is I think the governor of the team. These are the people who are making the decision, not Damian Lillard.
It's the organization. And the reality is there's a very good chance that Chauncey Billups outlasts Damian Lillard within the Portland Trailblazers organization.
Apparently an increasing chance that happens.
I feel like resting any of the responsibility on an athlete in particular and with an employee of the organization, I think is a pretty clear power imbalance that's going on there of somebody who...
Well, I mean, look, star players carry unusual degrees of power in the NBA. They've worked hard to accumulate that power. Now, sometimes what happens when you get that is you've got to deal with the choices that are made. So it's not, again, I don't think it's totally unfair, but I do think, again, the bulk of the criticism should go to the Blazers organization.
And they made the hire. Like, Damian Lillard is not negotiating with Chauncey Billups.
No.
Damian Lillard is not hosting this press conference.
He's not conducting the investigation.
It's very strange to me how much of this, but also, like,
I mean, it was very unusual for him to speak so publicly in favor of outside candidates. That's just not really a thing that happens. So I would hope he learned something from that.
Yes. But it's still, the organization made this decision. Damian Lillard did not make this decision. He's an athlete. He's not sending offers to coaches. He's not negotiating contracts. He is a basketball player. And his role within the team is to be a basketball player. It's to be an ambassador for the city of Portland at the same time. And he spoke without knowing the full complexity and the details of what he was speaking about.
Which is, I pointed out on the Hoop Collective, I didn't remember this either until I saw the post on Blazers Edge that talked about, you know, the background of the reasons to be against the hire of both Kidd and Billups. Like, obviously, Kidd's domestic violence history is better known, because it happened during the heart of his playing career when it was more publicized. But Billups had, I think, been largely forgotten until now.
And I think it's more concerning to me that given all of this information, given all the information and the response that the Blazers had, that they chose to continue to go forward with this. And it makes me think that there's either some questionable people who are making decisions within the Blazers organization, or there's a real lack of a power structure within the Blazers organization. And I think it has led them to a pretty baffling place to be.
I was reminded by this story, in this story, or the discussion of it, that Jodie Allen was accused of sexual harassment in her role as Vulcan CEO by some members of the security detail for her and Paul Allen, who filed lawsuits against that organization. So, all right. Well, should we talk about Seattle sports?
We need a basketball team back in Seattle.
The Mariners making history. Reliever Hector Santiago became the first player in MLB history ejected. Well, I guess not in MLB history, but since the ban on crackdown on foreign substances, ejected for having a foreign substance on his glove, which carries a 10-game suspension. Santiago was leaving the game when umpires inspected his glove and ejected him. Santiago said post-game that what the umpires thought was a foreign substance was a mixture of rosin and sweat that became sticky and is appealing the suspension. Mariners manager Scott Service objected to the description of it as a foreign substance because rosin is allowed on the mound, but applying rosin to the baseball is in fact illegal. So,
now you wanted me to do a Mariners hot takes about how the Mariners aren't even good at cheating.
I mean, look, this is not the Astros here.
I don't know if the Astros were good. When you see they're cheating, they're just like, you banged a trash can. I mean, I'm like, what kind of fucking steampunk level of cheating were the Astros
it does
doing?
Seem pretty obvious in hindsight. But I'm saying that when the Astros were cheating, they were winning the fucking World Series. They weren't like a few games over 500 with a terrible
run. I think the Astros had a good team and were also cheating.
I think that the cheating is not actually that bad.
But also, I rejected your idea of doing a Mariners hot takes about this because I reject the investigation
that's
by baseball.
Why. You rejected it because you did not understand what was going on.
What was going on?
You developed this take 30 seconds before we started the podcast.
No. I had this particular take beforehand.
Okay.
I reject the idea of baseball being concerned with foreign substances whatsoever.
I mean, look, the game has become too pitcher-friendly, so I think that it...
Then let the hitters do steroids.
I don't know that it's a one-for-one correlation there.
I am for steroids. I am for foreign substances. I am for anything to make the sport of baseball more interesting.
Well, the foreign substances are making a lot less hitting, so I don't know if it has been working to make baseball more interesting.
Literally anything, and that's why I maybe even am for these investigations, because somebody talked about baseball for once.
Oh, I mean, look, this is the most we've talked about the Mariners in a few weeks here.
The entire point of baseball is to be entertainment. There is literally no point for baseball to exist outside of entertainment, right? Other than
what if baseball just like rebrands itself as a reality show, reality programming, and these investigations are the focus of it?
I think that might be fun. It is to sell sponsorship dollars. It is to sell TV deals, tickets to games, and concessions at games. And maybe parking. That's what that is the point of baseball existing. It is for entertainment to make those things happen. And baseball has been doing a kind of bad job of those things for like the last two decades.
Oh, wow.
So give me foreign substances
since
right
1998,
now.
Apparently.
What happened in 1998?
Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, the home run chase.
That was really fun, right?
Yeah, that was the point. Is that when they had the cheating, it was fun.
When was the last time you cared about baseball?
Probably the 2000 ALCS, I would say, is the last time I really cared.
The 2000 ALCS?
Yeah, I think that was about when I lost, really, really lost interest.
Cheating is good.
It overlapped exactly with when I started caring about basketball as much as I do.
You think that was the year?
It was when the Sonics hired Nate McMillan. It's when I got way more into basketball. And it was that year because I was a freshman in college, and in high school, like I had been doing a lot of homework and working and doing that on school nights, and so therefore was not like paying as much attention to the Sonics as I could to the Mariners in the summer. And then when I did not have the same workload in college, it all of a sudden became a lot more easier for me to care about the Sonics. So they became my number one, and the Mariners became a team that we talk about when their pitchers get suspended. One of the teams ahead of them in that power ranking of my attention. The Seattle Sounders, who got a 2-1 win Wednesday versus Real Salt Lake, and then a 2-2 draw Saturday versus Vancouver. On Wednesday, Christian Roldan finished a rebound of a saved Will Bruin shot he set up with Raul Ruiz Diaz, also providing a great pass in the buildup. Stephen Cleveland conceded a penalty in the 78th minute, converted by Albert Rushniak. Then the Sounders got their own PK through a handball in the 87th minute, and Raul Ruiz Diaz converted with a Panenka. Impressively, to get the Sounders the full points. They stayed unbeaten Saturday at 7-0-4 this season, but definitely felt like two lost points versus the weak Whitecaps. Sounders had a 1-0 lead through Ruiz Diaz at halftime, but conceded twice early after halftime, and including a miscue in A.B. Sissoko, got beat, and Stephen Cleveland unsuccessfully came out to the edge of his box to try to play sweeper-keeper. Sounders did equalize with a goal by substitute Jimmy Madranda shortly after he replaced Sissoko, but couldn't find the winning goal, with Vancouver more than happy to play for a draw, despite being dominated by the Sounders in terms of expected goals. Sounders on the road this weekend. They'll play on the 4th of July, as MLS likes to do, at Colorado. So we'll see the viewership for that one. Tougher weekend for OL Reign, which suffered a 3-0 loss at home Saturday to Gotham FC. They'll be playing Friday night at Houston. Just one game for the Seattle Storm last week. It was the first week in a while that no Storm player was named Western Conference Player of the Week, not even Brianna Stewart. That lone game, a 95-92 overtime loss Sunday at Las Vegas, a heartbreaker in a battle of the two best teams in the WNBA. It was a tied game with 52.7 seconds left in regulation. The Storm tied it up on a gorgeous pseudo Brianna Stewart pick and roll. Stewie then missed on the final possession and couldn't get a good look at the basket on a last second inbound pass as time expired. A Chelsea Gray three-point play put the Aces up by one with 26.4 seconds left in OT. Stewie gave the Storm back the lead with two free throws, but Gray knocked down a pull-up with 10.6 seconds left, and Bird missed a deep pull-up three when both pick-and-roll defenders went with Stewie, and that was basically that for this one. That win gives the Aces the head-to-head tiebreaker in the season series. They moved into a tie for first place at 12-4 with a win earlier Wednesday night. Storm does still have the inside track to represent the West in the Commissioner's Cup, because Las Vegas dropped a Commissioner's Cup game Friday at Minnesota. The Storm is one game up with four to play in the Commissioner's Cup standings, and that tiebreaker will be decided by aggregate Commissioner's Cup point differential, which the Storm currently leads. Their remaining four Commissioner's Cup games are a home-and-home series with both Los Angeles and Phoenix, the former starting on Sunday in LA after they host Atlanta on Friday night. And to the listener who was asking, we do not know for sure whether the Commissioner's Cup is an actual cup, because we have not seen a physical, they have not unveiled the physical cup just yet.
If it's not a cup, it's not a cup.
That's the rules. Mm-hmm. That's the rules.
Thank you.
It's no Symetra Cup.
Yes. Per EA Sports rules, if it is not in the game, it's not in the game. And if it's not a cup, it is not a cup.
Those are the rules.
Also, if you can't drink out of it. Let's say that it's a cup, but it's filled to the top and you can't drink out of it, still not a cup.
Yeah, like, I mean,
you have to be able to drink out of a cup.
Yeah, I thought that was implied.
It could be bell-shaped. But if you can't drink out of it, it is not a cup.
Could it be cylindrical?
Could be.
Conical?
Maybe.
College sports news. With Congress failing to create a comprehensive national rule ahead of state name, income, and likeness legislation taking effect on Thursday, the NCAA has adopted an interim policy proposed by six conference leaders, including the Pac-12, allowing those rules to guide schools in the 11 states with NIL legislation kicking in, while the others, including Washington, will create their own policies based on NCAA guidelines prohibiting boosters from paying players and the use of endorsements in recruiting. UW in particular has been prepping for this moment. In February, they launched their, quote, Boundless Futures program, the release of which notes that Boundless Futures leverages UW's alumni network in the Seattle business community to build leaders in life and the workplace through practical experiences and connections. Though universities will be prohibited from directly participating in an NIL activity, the UW can enable student athletes to make connections and locate resources to support their endeavors and provide best-in-class education to equip them with the tools needed to capitalize on opportunities.
What the fuck does that mean?
It basically means that they're going to connect the players with people who might be interested in offering them endorsements.
They will connect the players with people who will pay the players.
Yes. So
that was the worst sentence paragraph that I've ever heard in my entire life.
It sounded like it was written in business school, which the Foster School of Business is a part of this. WSU today,
as far as I've heard.
That's the law school, not the business school.
Yeah, I heard the business school is not that much better.
Well, it's because I mean, it was undergrad, but it was because I was there. WSU announced a similar
crew. They didn't teach you about the word overwrought.
No, they did not. You had to look it up. You didn't know it either.
I was just confirming.
Okay.
Yeah.
WSU announced a similar Cougar Pursuit program today.
Oh, God. Did they have a description too? Please read it.
I did not read their full press release. Although, well, the one thing they said was they called WSU like Washington's premier athletic. I forget what the description was exactly, but it was
athletics and athletics and cheese institution. Oh Lord!
I mean, like, I don't know if I've ever had Cougar Gold cheese, but I take people's word for it.
Oh, I'm sure it's great cheese.
Yeah,
yeah. It's more than you can say about the University of Washington,
the most recognizable and influential collegiate athletic brand in the Evergreen State. Which I feel like they're probably a solid third. I mean, Gonzaga.
I don't know.
Gonzaga played in the fucking national championship game in men's basketball this year.
What they're saying is that people, there is a network of people who have coordinated to fly the WSU flag behind College Game Day for decades.
If they want to say the most recognizable and influential logo in the Evergreen State, I'm with you on that one. It's a great logo.
I'm not sure if that's true.
I mean, our logo is just a W. It's not really that recognizable or influential.
I guess
so. It was pretty similar to the Winnipeg Blue Bombers logo, if you gotta be honest.
All the time I'm like, wait, is that Huskies or the Blue Bombers? When we were driving to eat the chicken on Saturday, and Luca was pointing out Husky Stadium, and he was like, is that beautiful stadium or their Husky Stadium? And I was like, no. That's the Winnipeg Blue Bombers Stadium.
I guess it's not actually that similar. There's this empty. It's not full in, but the font is very similar.
Bombers, yeah, and you have to say that UW is actually the University of Wisconsin. So,
UW players will be able to use school trademarks with approval from UW's marketing and communication office in those endorsements. That's something that some of the state rules prohibit, but others don't.
So, the thing that I'm happy about this. To some capacity. However, the issue here is that just allowing players to be paid by boosters or whatever representing the school, and look, maybe it comes back to the school themselves, but it is still not the players getting paid by the institutions themselves. And I think there was some quotes from members of the Supreme Court that there's basically no other situation in the capitalist society that we live in where you can monetize employees, but then not pay those employees because your argument is that they're amateurs.
And specifically, like, argue that the popularity of the thing is due to not paying people.
Yeah.
It's like, no, that, I mean, the delightful thing about that case reaching the Supreme Court was it's like all the obviously ridiculous things got exposed by the Supreme Court.
If the Supreme Court weren't so bad, it would have been really fun.
I mean, in this case, the lenience of the Supreme Court actually may have been something of a positive.
Them being pro-business. Oh, Lord. But the thing is, just opening it up for other people to pay the athletes is still not the ideal solution. The ideal solution is you pay the fucking players from the people who are making the money, right? The boosters, the school, aren't making money off the sport. They probably are in tangential ways. But, like, they're not making money from the TV deals. They're not making money from the sponsorship deals. They're not making money from the ticket sales, right? When we bought these fucking tickets, when they open up capacity to 100% for Husky Stadium for next year, the boosters didn't get dollars in their pockets. The players didn't get dollars in their pockets. The college got dollars in their pockets. And that money did not go back to the players. And that's still what the issue is.
A lot of the money does go back to the players. It just, a lot of it goes to the players in non-revenue sports, which is not necessarily an equitable distribution of it in terms of the racial diversity in those sports as compared to the revenue sports.
I'm still skeptical of that as a concept as well. I think you can have other sports, but there are still infrastructures that exist where you're able to have other sports that don't accrue the same amount of money as football does, but pay football athletes. Also, I would be fine with them paying crew athletes too. This is not exclusive to football. If there are sports that are generating...
More that those sports aren't generating revenue.
Maybe use some of the tuition to generate the revenue for those other sports. There's other places that a school makes money aside from football TV deals.
I mean, I don't agree that it would be a good idea to dip out of the general fund to pay athletes. I don't think that would be a good idea.
I'm for it.
Tuition is already too damn high.
But the point is, this gets us halfway there. But this is still deflecting where the actual responsibility exists. And the responsibility is on the institutions to pay the players. Allowing somebody to get paid by somebody else is not the same as paying somebody. That's like being like, well, you can be an intern and you can get exposure. And because of that exposure, maybe somebody else will want to pay you. But we're still providing you with a place to get money from somebody else. We're not willing to do it ourselves.
Better than saying you're an intern and therefore you're not allowed to do all these other things.
Just, I mean, all that you're doing is arguing how supremely fucked up it was before, and now it is just mildly fucked up.
I think that one of the most difficult things for us to acknowledge is this thing is not as bad as it used to be before, but this thing still needs to get better. And that's why I think where we are with the NCAA. And
it just, so it's many things always the same with the NCAA, though. It's always inch after inch after inch after inch, right? The NCAA
I think we gained several yards on this one.
I don't know. Maybe there's yards, but like the NCAA still has not had the reckoning that it needs to have.
I mean, that Supreme Court case was pretty reckoning.
I don't think it was. I don't think we're there until we get to the point that student athletes are being paid for the generating of revenue that they're doing. We are still not there. They're giving this up because they're scared of the other part. You understand that, right? They are giving this up because they're like,
because they have no choice states forced their hands. Like either, you know, you would have had to have all of the states in those schools secede from the NCAA and play their own thing, or the NCAA had to come along with it.
There's much more likely to be a reckoning in basketball where there are other outside forces that may actually...
I mean, the interesting thing is going to be how much basketball players all of a sudden are able to make through endorsements, and whether it's a similar amount to what you would make, you know, the NBA is paying players to play for the G League Ignite, that sort of thing.
It actually probably could be better for...
I think it very much could be better.
Ugh, God, I hate college sports. Ugh.
So, we'll see.
They're not even fun to watch.
Yeah. Ugh. College football is. By the time you listen to this podcast...
For like 4 games a year, college football is fun to watch.
So many college athletes will have already announced their endorsements. So, like... the Clemson quarterback who was already tweeting about Delta Airlines last week. Did you see that?
No. Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Yeah. So.
About it.
All right. On that note. You're not even giving a thanks for listening.
Agree with me about this? That
I don't not agree with
but
you.
That's what...
celebrate this thing without giving up the continued fight for the other thing.
I don't know if we can. I think this is a situation where if you will let the institutions take the W and everybody's like, cool, we're good, and we leave it here, it's not enough.
I don't think that everyone is that like that.
But fair enough.
And we're getting back NCAA football at some point.
The video game?
Yeah.
Well, that's something. At least the players will be paid for it.
Maybe Fantasy Genius will be very excited.
It'll be fun. All right. Thanks for listening.
Thanks. Wait, did you do hot takes?
I didn't do hot takes. I don't. Well, should I have?
I know it's too late now.
I had some hot takes that were... I literally do not know what was going on with the Mariners.
I told you what you had to do the hot takes about.
About what?
About getting suspended for the foreign substances.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I totally even forgot that happened.
Oh, wow.
What would the takes be?
So about the Mariners are cheating.
That the Mariners are even bad at cheating.
They're cheating their way to barely above 500 with a horrible run differential.
But we're anti the stupid rules about the foreign substances.
I don't know if we are anti that.
You're pro foreign substance rules?
Are you pro foreign substances?
I think I am.
Oh, wow. This is quite a debate. Quite a debate.
You're not pro foreign? I'm pro everything.
I mean,
within this world of capitalism, I am laissez-faire as can be, right? If we're going to be in a capitalist society, why don't we go all the fucking way?
All right. Well, that's a take.
With baseball? Like, what the hell?